Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is our teacher, mentor, friend, Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. Welcome back, Blair. It's always great to see you.
Great to see you too, Alan.
Okay, let me start this way. Education, higher education, is now in real trouble. It costs so much for a independent or private education. We're talking about, you know, $60,000 in some cases.
That's
it's crazy. And the state university, when I went to Hunter, it was for free. Now the state university can set you back a little bit.
Yeah, and what you're starting to see are increasing debt loads for college students, even coming out of public colleges in New York. The average debt load now is roughly, when you graduate, roughly $25,000-$26,000. And that can have an impact on the career decisions of college graduates. It can set them back in terms of their ability to get mortgages or to have other kinds of decisions in terms of how they spend their money, because they're going to have to pay off these school loans when they graduate. And so effectively, the public policy has been over the last number of years now, decades, has been to shift the cost of public college from the tax levy of the state, the tax treasury, the state treasury, from there to the families of the college students. And that's led to, not surprisingly, big increases in the costs, as well as the debt loads that students have to bear.
Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about the governor of New York and SUNY. We saw an announcement this year that Nancy Zimpfer, just a couple of weeks ago, the wonderful chancellor of the State University of New York is leaving. I don't like that one bit because she's been terrific. She is 70 years old, but
a young 70
years old. A young 70 year old, that's right. But then also, Andrew Cuomo has somehow glommed on to SUNY and has made a whole bunch of stuff with it. For example, there's the now famous, or some might say infamous, SUNY Polytech. And the guy who runs it is a guy by the name of Alain Calieros. And we have heard that he's been subpoenaed to come and talk about the way contracts have been let. Right. And also that if you start a business on a SUNY campus, you get tax relief for doing it. And now the whole pay-to-play debate is going on around there. And as a 40-year teacher at SUNY, I'm not happy that the purpose of education may be misinterpreted here.
Well, the governor is clearly using the State University of New York as the backbone of his economic development strategy for upstate. And he has, as you mentioned, there's all of these high-tech centers that he's creating along I-90 from Buffalo to Albany. And those strategies, they're reasonable enough, if you're careful about it and everything else. But the fact that a lot of those decisions, those economic development decisions, were made in secret, and they've even gone as so far as to create not-for-profit entities so that they could make decisions exempt from the freedom of information, or they argue anyway, from the freedom of information and open meetings laws. That sort of black box economic development stuff has drawn the attention of the U.S. Attorney's Office. And there are allegations, and, we don't know how it'll play out, of course. Subpoenas don't necessarily mean indictments or convictions, that some of the governor's people and his allies were using it as their own little cookie jar to make money off of it. Time will tell, of course, but there have been allegations in Buffalo in particular, where the Buffalo Billion, which flows through some of those centers, has been involved in terms of enriching big campaign contributors out in that area. Again, just I want to be crystal clear, you never know how this is all going to play out. Everything may be on the up and up. But when you have sort of an opaque sort of system of doling out hundreds of millions of dollars, you create an environment in which bad things can happen. A more open process may have slowed down the parade a little bit, and that's the governor doesn't like slow parades, he likes fast ones, may have slowed down the parade a bit, but may have certainly made it a far less likely that somebody could have gamed the system.
So you mentioned these not-for-profit foundations that were involved in all this. And didn't I read somewhere that the head of the Polytech operation and one of the governor's closest allies, Elaine Calieros, resigned from those places? Yeah. What was that all about?
Part of it, I think, is the scrutiny that is drawn from the U.S. Attorney's Office, the possibility that he may be exerting too much influence over decisions that were going through all of these various, you know, semi-governmental entities. You know, I mean, I think the public argument was that he was busy doing what he was doing at Poly, and therefore didn't have the time for all these other activities.
I mean, that was the public argument he used.
That's right.
But then there are some other alternative hypotheses.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. You get into deep doo-doo, and you don't want to have those people in the doo-doo category running the heads of these not-for-profits. Again, we don't know if anything bad is going to come out of this stuff, but to pull him back from his deep involvement in running a number of entities, I think, is a way to sort of respond to the U.S. attorney's interest in what these entities are doing and to sort of rein him in a bit.
Well, the question is, did he jump or was he pushed? I mean, you know, those are always the kinds of questions you just don't know.
That's right. That's right. To be fair, I mean, some of this stuff with SUNY goes.
To be fair,
it goes back even to the Pataki administration, as you may recall, the SUNY Research Foundation drew a lot of scrutiny when it was used for some no-show jobs or little-show jobs for relatives of the former Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno.
I do remember that.
So the idea that the state university and government generally is being used as a way to sort of advance partisan political interests or enrich so-called public servants, you know, it goes back a ways. And sadly, the current administration is now the recipient of many of these subpoenas.
Yeah. Well, certainly you are correct in saying that nobody's been indicted for anything and nobody's accused anybody yet of a crime. But, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And
there's definitely a lot of smoke.
U.S. attorneys don't go around subpoenaing you just for the joy of saying good morning.
That's exactly right.
That is for sure. Okay, let's go on. Now, there is this quid pro quo, pay-to-play business with lobbyists. You're a lobbyist, but of course you're a not-for-profit lobbyist.
There's no quid, there's a pro, but there's no quo.
Right. So is there some way, this is all beginning to not pass the stink test. It began a long time ago. You've been warning us about this for years, but we have a so-called lobbying commission. We have all these other groups that are supposed to be doing their jobs, but they're not really, are they?
Well, the problem we have in New York are these agencies that regulate lobbying and ethics and elections are all really captive agencies. They're not independent. They're captive to the political parties or the governor and the legislative leaders, and they're not truly independent. And that's where all of the problems of Albany, I would argue, stem from that fact. That you can have the best laws in the world, and if nobody's enforcing them properly, then, you know, what good are the laws? And you need to have cops walking the beat, independent of political pressure, following the law without fear or favor, and we don't have that. And they're structured that way. They're written into the law to be captive agencies. And as a result, you know, they whack the mid-level bureaucrat, you know, for doing something, but they don't go after the big fish. And we've even seen there's been recent revelations of some lobbyists close to the governor who was listed as a lobbyist at a prominent local lobbying firm, and then when they canned him because he got subpoenaed by the U.S. attorney, his name magically disappeared from the state's database. Now, maybe there's a good reason for that, but it certainly underscores the rightful public skepticism that the state-based agencies are doing their job. And right now, the only person really walking the beat are the feds, U.S. Attorney Preparara.
I'm a little bit confused here. One of the things that I've heard is that the governor, after arguing for these ethics groups, tries like hell to make sure his people are running them.
Right.
And so there really isn't this independence.
No, therein lies the rub, right? I mean, everyone's so terrified that someone will come along that's actually independent and start whacking people. I think it makes them nervous. And so they'd rather have entities that they control, the governor and legislative leaders or the political parties in the case of the elections, which are, again, creatures of the legislative and the governor anyway, you know, calling the shots. And that doesn't mean that the individuals are, you know, corrupt or unethical that are involved in the agencies. They're just structured that way. They're made to be a certain kind of thing. And as a result, not surprisingly, the state's top ethics watchdog, the Joint Commission on Public Ethics.
It's called Jay Cope,
and some have called it other things. The only three executive directors have all been, prior to becoming executive directors at the agency, the governor's staff.
This is after a national search, in
the so-called. Yeah. Yes, national search that just happens to be apparently begin and end with the political boundaries of the Albany County.
Well, that's pretty extraordinary. Let's go to practical presidential politics, Blair Horner, and see what we can come up with here. Obviously, Donald Trump, a New Yorker, is running against Hillary Clinton. That's the way it's looking right now.
Also a New Yorker.
A New Yorker. And the polls are showing, in New York, her way ahead. So people will be shrugging, listening to the show, and saying, so what? You know, I mean, you know, we know that she's going to win in New York. But it raises an interesting set of questions about the rest of the people who are running for political office. If a lot of Democrats to come out to vote for Hillary, right, then those Democrats will be around to vote, as we say, down ballot.
No, that's right.
And what does that portend?
Well, first thing, just to say, a year ago, if we were having this conversation, no one would be saying that Donald Trump would be the runaway winner with the Republican primary as a Republican nominee.
Certainly not me.
And so while the polling may tell you something right now, who knows what it's going to look like come the fall in terms of the fight. Now, if Hillary has a problem in New York, then she has a problem in the country. And for your listeners, I think it's the first time since there's been a New York to New York fight since Dewey versus, I guess, Roosevelt in the mid-1940s. So that goes back a long way. But you're right. I mean, the historic trend, certainly in recent times, has been in presidential years, the Democrats show up, and it has an impact, particularly in the state Senate races. And the control for the state Senate, 63 senators, there are 32 Democrats right now in the 63 Senate chamber, yet they do not control that House because there's a rump group of Democrats who ally themselves with the Republicans, and so the Republicans control the House. And if Hillary does win and win big in New York, the theory is that she would pull some of these state Senate candidates along with her, unless what you're alluding to, right, is if there's a drop-off. And if that's the case, then Senate Republicans may have a chance. But traditionally, in the last few election cycles, Democrats tend to do better in presidential years and tend to do worse in non-presidential years.
So I'm supposed to know what I'm talking about. I'm a political scientist, but I want to have you educate me on something. We know that this governor, in my mind, disgracefully allowed the Senate Republicans and the Assembly Democrats, who don't need the help, to structure their own districts, right, to draw their own districts.
I mean, in our view, it's the most gerrymandered lines in modern political history.
It's unbelievable. So in order to keep the Republicans in power, my hypothesis is that what the governor does is he says he's going to be against it, but then he does everything in his power to help the Republicans stay in power. So let me ask you a question. If the Democrats win, is there a law that says, there's a constitutional provision that says every 10 years you got to look at your numbers, but is there a law that says, as they did in Texas, you can't change the lines now?
No, that's a very good question. I think the short answer to that is there is no restriction on the legislature doing it, although it's never happened, other than in the 60s after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that one person, one vote should be the standard. And I believe that they had to deal with the redoing the Senate district lines in the mid-1960s as a result of that, although the state's constitution never changed. And one of the things about the state's constitution, it still has this unconstitutional provision in it that allows the state Senate to do something different. But I digress. I don't recall ever seeing anything that there's a prohibition. There may be, but I don't recall seeing anything in the Constitution, which would be the relevant document. It says that every 10 years you do it. I don't recall seeing anything in there, but it's been a while since I looked at this, that says you can't do it any other time. But I haven't ever seen it in New York history, well, at least modern history.
As I point out, it did happen in Texas, and they wiped out all these congressional districts that were held by the Democrats. So it's an interesting sort of precedent. But the fight in New York, obviously, as you have just suggested, is over the state Senate.
That's right.
Now, even with all of these maldistricted places, Senate districts, this still is an absolute possibility that the Democrats will take the state Senate.
They have it now.
Well, they theoretically have it now.
Well, technically they have it.
But there
they
are
don't
some,
do it.
There is, you know, there are five traitors.
There are five members of the Independent Democratic Conference and one lone Democrat, Simca Felder from Brooklyn, who sits with the Republicans in conference.
So that's
six.
Six.
That's right.
Now, if Andrew Cuomo went to the six, what you call Independent Democratic Conference, I call this the six traitors who run as Democrats and then stab them in the back. If in fact that the governor went to them and said, "Look, I want you boys to go back where you came from, go back to the Democrats," would they have to?
Well, I mean, they don't have to do anything, but I would think that if the governor threw his political clout behind merging the breakaway Democrats with the mainstream Democrats, that's what would happen. I mean, the governor is by far the most powerful political figure in the state. He has the clout. He controls the purse strings of the state. For the breakaway Democrats to sort of run afoul of the governor could cause them real problems down the road. But there's nothing that technically says that they would have to follow what the governor tells them to do, although he is the leader of the party, and he could cause them problems. And I don't think it's a monolith. I think some of the members of the Independent Democratic Conference are in different places in terms of how they view what it is that they're doing, and some of them, for sure, would be very sensitive to what the governor had to say.
Well, there are those people who, I mean, it's very nice of you to say that, but there are a lot of people who feel that these five are no more than political prostitutes.
Well, certainly there are lots of oldest professions on the planet. Elected officials are one of them. In terms of what happens, you know, again, is technically the reason why now, because the Democrats took the Skello seat in April, that they don't control it is, again, these five breakaways. But the rules of the House say for you to change leadership now in the state Senate, you need an overwhelming majority of the senators to vote for it. And that's why things have sort of stayed in place.
So the election
right
is going to be
the election is key. The Clinton factor could loom quite large, particularly if it's somewhat contested, at least in New York. And there are a number of seats where there are Republican state senators in districts that have overwhelming Democratic enrollment advantages, particularly in the Hudson Valley and on Long Island.
Is there a chance that the governor, if he runs, 2018, if he runs for governor, that based on what you're seeing now, the progression, he could lose?
Well, you can always lose, right? Depends, but you got to have a horse. I mean, when his dad ran for his third term, he ran against Pierre Rinfrae. Herb London was the conservative candidate. And combined, they almost got 50%, though, and his dad only barely broke through the 50% mark to get it. Three terms is a long time, and it's usually a legacy killer when you get your third term. So I don't know what this governor is planning on doing until 2018.
I know he's going to run.
Well, he may, you know, if that's what he does, that's what he does. But
I know that
there's a long way to go, and his political fortunes may get better, may get worse.
Yeah. Okay. Talk to me about lead in the water. I know this is a scandal across the country. We're now finding out that people's drinking water has been compromised, Michigan, big time, other places. How are we doing in New York?
Well, there's increasing evidence that there's a big problem. There are 67 school districts now that have had to close at least one of their buildings due to high elevated lead levels tested in their drinking water supplies. New York has no requirement that the schools test for lead. They can, but there's no requirement to do so. And so you have these, and the federal standards that prohibit the use of lead in any form, either pipes or solder, only went into effect in 2014.
And some of these pipes are 100 years old?
That's right. And the solder, even in the more recent ones, the solder was often used as lead. And so it gets into the drinking water supply. So you want to test for it. There's no state requirement to do it. Both houses of the legislature have active bills to do it. They've run into opposition, largely from those who don't like school mandates. And despite the fact that you would think that this is one example of a school test that everyone could agree on, it is one where it's not entirely clear to me that the bill will even pass. And all the bill does is require a test. And then if it comes up positive, it gets tested again so you can figure out what to do. And if the test is fine, then it'll be up to the commissioner to issue regulations on how frequently you test after that. That's it. And that's the mandate that there are some that are opposed to. It's amazing.
It's unbelievable. These are our children we're talking
about.
That's right.
They're talking about testing to see if children are being poisoned at school. You would think everyone could agree that that's a bad thing.
I want to ask you one of the great perplexing questions that I've had about politics since I've been in the game, and it is, why is, just Charlie Brown said, why is Governor Cuomo always picking on de Blasio? What is going on here?
Well, I mean, I just
think it's stupid.
Well, the mayors and governors forever have slugged it out in New York. Right? I mean, Giuliani and Pataki, they played it very rough. In fact, Giuliani, as you may recall, even endorsed Mario Cuomo against Pataki. Bloomberg and Pataki and then Spitzer, you know, they had all their fights. In this particular case, it's more ferocious, I think, because the governor is a, you know, he's definitely a hard-charging sort of politician.
But doesn't there, he's obviously got some agenda here. Doesn't this hurt the governor? Forget about anything else.
Well,
his numbers are going down.
It's not clear. I mean, so is de Blasio's. It's not clear. I mean, if the governor is facing, I mean, his last time he ran, he faced a challenge from the left in terms of the primary. And she did very reasonably well considering how underfunded and unknown she was. If there's a real challenge going into 2018, it's going to come from New York City, right? That's the way it plays. So do you want to have a mayor who is viewed as a foe? And so I think the governor is probably trying to certainly lay the groundwork where a mayor who gets elected in 2017 is favorable to the governor. Now, it doesn't mean that de Blasio is not that person, but it may be that de Blasio would pledge some version of fealty to the governor going into 2018. I think a lot of this has to do with that.
Well, it started that they were friends, that de Blasio had worked for Cuomo, that they knew each other. In fact, de Blasio, as I remember it, got Cuomo through the Working Party's family
nomination. That's right.
But something has just been more puzzling to me. I've talked to an awful lot of people about this, and nobody can really give me a satisfactory answer.
The people who know this are, of course, the people that you don't have on your show. But, I mean, the two big factors are you have always the alpha male fight between the mayor of the city of New York and the governor of the state of New York. That's always been there, coupled with I think that this governor's concern that if he faces an electoral challenge in 2018, and at least in the primary, it's going to emerge out of New York City, and the last thing in the world he needs is a really implacable foe down there. Now, you could argue that fighting with the mayor may make him the implacable foe, but, you know, so I'm not 100% sure what the political calculation is, but I assume that part of what I'm saying is what he's thinking.
Very quickly, I only have a minute left, but if Donald Trump becomes the president of the country, what does that portend for New York?
Well, I mean, he's a New Yorker, so he's going to be sensitive to some of the urban issues, particularly of New York City, in a way that probably other presidents would not be. But his ideological agenda is one that I think New Yorkers, which are overwhelmingly Democrats, would view with some concern, particularly in the Supreme Court choices.
Our guest has been the remarkable Blair Horner, executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group. And Blair, I know how hard you work for all of us, and I so appreciate it. And I think you really are a smart guy, so thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.